Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hidden Hearing. Hearing problems? We've been tuning people in for over 30 years. Visit hiddenhearing.ie.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. I think it's about 6 or 7 years ago when we first mentioned self-published books. And we got a response, a fascinating response, but it just got bigger and bigger and bigger each year. And this is a time of year to try and give authors who've put an enormous amount of work, not just into writing their book, but actually getting it published and distributed. And let's begin, because we've an awful lot to get through, and they are all, without exception, fascinating, with fascinating stories in them and indeed behind them. Cyril Meehan. Cyril, good afternoon.
Joe, how are you? Thanks very much for giving me the time.
Your self-published book is called Experiences of an Irish Policeman, and it's in dark blue. The story of who saved your life when you were drowning.
Well, as a child, I was about 14 years of age down here in Westport, and I went out of my depth in the sea, and I had flippers on for the first time, and I went straight down. And I had three friends on the coastline looking at me and were in shock. They could do nothing. Was a man who I knew very well, Gary Kennedy, who was his family and himself were friends of the family, came along on a bicycle, immediately saw the problem, jumped in and saved my life. And I write about it and I acknowledge him. And he didn't get proper acknowledgement for it at the time, because he was a strong Republican. His grandfather would have been from the old IRA, and he was a proud Republican. And as a result, as a guard son, I'm a third generation, as it were, policeman. So he didn't get the acknowledgement he deserved, and he's one of the many people in the book I acknowledge for that.
And you remember being under that water?
The shock of it, you know, the typical thing with the say, time slows down. It's so slow, your mind is racing so fast, you think of everything. As you come up and down in the water, you can see him trying to get the life buoy off the stand, and it's not coming off. You know, you say to yourself, he's not going to do it, I know it's all wound up wrong. And you go down and you hear the tug of water and you know it's him jumping in. And it's quite a scary experience, all right.
And then when he did get you out of the water, Gary Kennedy, an older lady arrived along and she thought you were closer to death than you actually were. What did she do to you?
Well, she started bouncing up and down on my back and banging my back. And sure, just to appease the woman, I had to spit out some spittle just to... I actually have swallowed water at the stage. But it was kind of funny, in the middle of all this, she was... beating the hell out of me, and I had to just acknowledge she was doing her best for me and play along, as it were, you know.
Now, you were a guard during the Troubles.
I was a guard. I was a detective. I ended up as a detective sergeant, and this book, In Dark Blue, is actually a very dark blue book. It covers a lot of serious things, and it's quite contemporary, Joe, in that it deals with the border and the difficulties. If the start Brit exit a hard border again, I deal with dealing with the Troubles and the IRA. I deal with car chases and the frustration of working along the border, and near-death experiences with working on the border. Funny incidences that I've covered as well, but I certainly was up there during the Troubles, and it's great that we've moved on from all that.
Well, remind people of a case you were involved in towards the end, the Patsy Gillespie case
That was a poor, unfortunate Catholic who worked in a military installation, and IRA decided to use him as a proxy bomb. And there was three bombs that night, Joe, in different parts of Northern Ireland. We were to put three individuals into cars and vans and let them drive into British Army checkpoints. And the idea was to ignite by remote control a bomb and kill the people in those checkpoints. He unfortunately did it, and he knew he was carrying a 1,000-pound bomb, and his family were held hostage while he did it. And he did it, and he tried to escape, or the door was opened, and the explosive guy was devious enough that he'd wired the courtesy light in the roof of the car that if the door opened, it would ignite the bomb. And it killed him instantly and five soldiers in that checkpoint. And I dealt with some of the aftermath in dealing with the prisoners that were taken in, the people that were allegedly involved and caught a short distance away from the scene. It was a horrific story, an awful thing that happened, one of the most horrible things in the Troubles. And yet it's kind of consigned to history and buried. There's no memorial, and probably, Joe, never will be, to those soldiers at that place because it would be desecrated, you know.
And the Morris Tribunal, you were a member of the Garda Síochán in Donegal, and you say a lot of innocents had to put up with drunks jeering at them. What was it?
Oh, I mean, after that, the guards that had absolutely no involvement in the Morris Tribunal, like myself, had to take it in the neck and on the chin. We're dealing with the public and drunks or people who had an issue with the guards. It was great ammunition to throw at us, to call us corrupt and that we were doing all this, that and the other. And it was a very humbling, low morale time for guards, you know. Mm-hmm.
And the fact, Cyril, that this is self-published,
yes.
Does that mean you can be more forthright than...
Absolutely. It's refreshing, Joe. I'm retired now and I can say what I want and I'll tell you, the book is far from towing the company line. I know I'm a third-generation policeman, but as people read through it, I'm very hard on the organisation. I'm hard on myself. And, you know, where credit's due, I'll say it, but where I felt the organisation let people down, or which they have done in many cases, I put it, it's in the book. And as I say, it covers the same sort of scenarios like what happened with poor old Morris McCabe. It covers about eviction. I cover both the border and dealing with terrorism.
Because you were involved in one eviction, you say, of a Protestant farmer from a huge farm in Bournemouth.
Absolutely.
But maybe what you decided to do, tell us the way you decided to handle that eviction.
From the very outset, I was adamant that I would not be seen, and this is a lesson for current Gardaí, that I would not be seen to take any part or to be associated in any way with bouncers or security men or bailiffs or whatever you want to call them, in assisting them and grabbing people and taking them out of property. But besides that, Joe, what happened as well on that occasion, the security men had ballot papers covering their faces, and I said to the superintendent, I said, "Super, these people are causing attention and a threatening feeling here. We should not allow these guys to have masks on." And he agreed, and he ordered that to take them off. And, of course, a lot of them wouldn't take off the masks, and they had to leave the area because some of them were serving members of the Defence Forces, and maybe some of them were from Northern Ireland as well, like we have at the moment with the Roscommon thing. But it was not our place, and it's one of the things that I'm very unhappy about, that the organisation is tied up in all this thing at the moment.
Okay, well, there's loads of stories in it from beginning to end, all 254 pages. It's called... The experience of an Irish policeman in dark blue. You've already written one called The Ideal Guard. And CyrilMeehan.com is your website.
You're mentioned, Joe, actually, in the first book, in The Ideal Guard. It's still out for sale and it's selling very well. It's in its third print, even though it's self-published. But it was a story that you were interested in many years ago and I got on to you. I was in the guards at the time. And your researchers saw it on an internal magazine and they wanted to talk to me about it, but they couldn't because the authorities didn't want to.
And it was about a dummy or something. A shopkeeper used a dummy.
It was a silly, funny thing where a shopkeeper had left a dummy outside his shop at night time. And it shows you the times it was in the past. Nobody stole the Wellingtons that was on this mannequin. No one stole the plastic waterproof jacket that was on him and the hat on his head. And it was funny to see at 4 o'clock in the morning. And sure, we turned it into a joke and we pretended with one of our colleagues that there was a burglary taking place. And of course, he attacked the mannequin and tried to wrestle with it and it fell apart. But it was funny at the time, you know.
Okay, well, it's a fine book. Well done on putting it down. And it's part of a public record as well. Not enough guards or retired guards write of their experiences. It's called Experience of an Irish Policeman in Dark Blue. All the details will be up on our website. We're going to tweet each book as we go along as to where you can get it because they are self-published, which means that they are not available generally in the shops with some exceptions of individual
shops. Well, this one is available, Joe. It's available almost nationwide in all the major
Eastons
and good bookshops.
Well done. Very well distributed. Well done. That's Cyril Meehan. Let us stick with law enforcement and go to Hal Hennigan. Hal, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, yeah.
Your self-published books. Tell us about it and why and who it features.
Well, listening to Cyril there, actually, there are so many echoes of an earlier era. My book deals with the Royal Irish Constabulary, the predecessors of the Guards. But a great deal of the problems that force faced are echoed in what Cyril was saying. Like we should be mindful today of the opprobrium that the RIC got through its involuntary association with the evictions of the 1880s. It took them a long time to get over the public animosity that was caused by their presence at evictions.
And your father was in a constable in the Royal Irish Constabulary from 1912 to 1922.
From 1912, yeah.
And by the way, what did he do when they were disbanded?
That was a great problem for many, because British police forces generally didn't want them. The colonies didn't particularly welcome them either. And quite a few went to America. Some actually joined the Palestine police, but they were usually, it was more the temporaries, the black and tans and the auxiliaries that went into that. But my father went to America and was there about 10 years and then returned and became a publican, as many a policeman did in his time.
And in researching his life, because I think there is a point, like I think this year and the Haunted Soldier in St. Stephen's Green, I think this year was a turning point, a milestone in Irish people as a body, remembering those who died from Ireland in the First World War. Now, the next big project is to tell the story of the RIC, apart from the caricature of the RIC, because it hasn't, they haven't got a good reputation, unfortunately. Is that part of your aim?
Very much so, because I think I started off by focusing on my father initially, but there was so little information about a lowly constable that my inevitably, I began to look at the wider picture. And I think, in fact, they were very unfairly treated in that caricature that emerged afterwards, the stereotype. Even the idea of them as an armed force, which, the way it's presented, it sounds something very malevolent, malignant. But in fact, when we look at it, by 1912, generally speaking, the RIC were conducted themselves as an unarmed police force. Mm. There were rifles issued. There was training in musketry and all of that. But by and large, it was an object that they used less frequently than a shovel. And they had no reason to. At that stage, there was actually a considerable and continuing groundswell of agitation towards becoming totally disarmed. And there were good reasons for that. One was the big bugbear in the RIC was the cadet system, the two-tier system of entry.
The officer and the men. But I'm going to move you on because did many of, and I know your father didn't, but did many of those from the disbanded RIC in 1922, any of them join the Garda Síochána?
Well, quite a few did.
Okay, and how were they treated in there?
There were problems because while Collins, notably, and some of those around him were very aware of, well, there were RIC who had been directly involved in helping the IRA, but generally speaking, they needed the expertise for the new force. It was the only model they had.
Okay, well, maybe I think your book will assist in the knowledge of the RIC. By the way, you mentioned, obviously, the book is about your father. It's called The World of Constable John Hennigan by Hal Hennigan. But you tell me at the end, my son died in Sydney after a short illness in 2011. Obviously, he was quite young. He left a completed manuscript of a graphic novel.
A comic novel.
A comic novel, okay. Sorry.
But all I've done now is...
And you're going to publish that?
Prepare for publication.
Okay, and what's that called? Have you put a title?
Radio Wonderland.
Okay. What was your son's first name, Hal?
Owen.
Okay. What age was he when he passed away?
38.
Oh, God. Okay, well, by the way, it's a noble project you've undertaken, and you've undertaken it. It's full of research, references, nearly 400 pages, and again, all the details going on, and photographs, by the way. It's called The World of Constable John Hennigan, the Royal Irish Constabulary, 1912 to 1922. Hal Hennigan. Thanks indeed, Hal Hennigan. John Fury, what's the name of your book, your self-published book?
It's Good Morning, Mr. S. H**TTYYY Bottom.
Okay, we can work that.
I can't really pronounce it on the radio.
We can work that one out. Is it a it's a memoir?
It's a memoir about a 35-year advertising career spent all over the world, from Saudi Arabia to Hong Kong, Vietnam, Kenya, Dubai, Bahrain, everywhere.
And by the way, did you try and approach a publisher?
I made a brief stab at it, but I didn't seem to get much response. If you send stuff to editors, it just ends up on a slush pile for months and months and months. And I thought, given that most people now sort of tend to read blogs and things, it would be a better way to get it out there straight away. But I've had problems with the title, unfortunately. So that's worth a book on its own.
And tell us about you managed to get the Spice Girls banned in Vietnam.
I did. When I was working in Vietnam, one of our clients was a big soft drinks company. I can't really mention the name because I don't want to get sued. And their main rival used the Spice Girls in commercials.
Okay.
And Vietnam being very, very communistic, we decided that we would write a campaign of letters into the TV stations denouncing these scantily clad harpies. And promptly the ads were pulled and had to be re-edited. So the client that I worked for was very happy with that.
So you generated some fake news?
Basically, years ahead of the time, yeah.
And John, where does the title come from, Good Morning, Mr. S-H-I-T-T-Y Bottom?
I don't think you should have said that, Joe.
Okay, I didn't.
It's about Hong Kong. When you go to Hong Kong, one of the first things you do when you get a job there is they give you a business card.
Yeah.
And you get a Chinese name. And if what you should really do is make sure you get the name checked out by people, more than one person, and also not upset the people that you've got to give you name options. And one guy I worked with was very, very rude to the Chinese. His name was, in the book, it's Bob Seifert. That's not his actual name, but it's close enough. And they gave him the name Bo Seifert, which means big S-H apostrophe T-T-Y bottom.
But you say the first thing you do when you arrive in Hong Kong is get a business card and it pays to have three opinions. What do you mean?
Well, it pays to get, when you're working, you get a business card from your company, but it pays to get two or three people to check it.
Oh, good point, yeah.
To make sure that it's not embarrassing.
Okay, tell us about meeting the head of the CIA.
That was when my wife and I moved back to Roscommon 5 years ago. I got family here, uncles and aunties. My dad grew up here. And he was staying in a hotel in Roscommon called Gleason's. Other hotels are available. And we met him. He was, strangely enough, staying in the middle of the hotel, and we were at the very, very front until my wife and I worked out that if there was going to be anybody throwing bombs through the window, we'd be the ones who were expendable, whereas he wasn't. And
John Brennan's main enemy is Donald Trump.
Well, who, of course, owns his own hotels as well. So you never know whether he might be coming to Roscommon soon. He was very charming. His father knew my father very, very well, so I was more interested in talking to him than actually schmoozing with the CIA. But he was a very nice man, very polite, very generous.
Okay, well, it's a big tome, nearly 450 pages. It's called Good Morning, Mr. S.H. Blake, etc. Bottom by John Fury, and it's available on Kindle for €3 and hardback Amazon for €13. Details going up on the site. Now, let me go to John Hooton. John, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. It's called The Way We Were. It's a picture book, beautifully printed. Tell us, you sell it to the listeners.
Okay, the book is called Ireland, The Way We Were. I've been photographing abandoned houses for the last 5 years. Basically, houses that have been abandoned by people for various reasons. And in the houses, items left behind, like holy pictures hanging on the wall, the Child of Prague, the Pope, John F. Kennedy, and then various pieces of furniture. People would have left these houses, immigration, they could have died and no family to take them over. And they're basically just deteriorating away, and I just decided I wanted to record them, and because it's a period of Irish culture that's basically disappeared.
They are stunning photographs with the old... By the way, how did you get into the houses if they're abandoned?
Well, first of all, I would identify the house that there's potential there, because some of the houses were might be turned into a farm building or something. Yeah, there could be sheep and so on of various things. So I'd basically look at the house first to see is there potential there, and then I would seek who find who owned it by asking different people. And because obviously you're on private property and you can't just go into them at will. So I'd basically approach people and tell them what I'm doing. They'd be kind of looking at me first to see what the hell am I going in there for, because usually these houses are fairly, you know, they've gone to a kind of a stage where you might want to go into them. Like, and once I kind of talk to them and tell them what I'm doing and get them interested, I'd also show them photographs of some of the ones I've done before, and give them a sense of what it's like. And obviously, I give them photographs then as well of what I take, and you know, I would print them and give them to them.
And how did you self-publish it? How? Tell us about that process.
Well, this is my third book actually. I was amateur 3 years ago. I'm basically a landscape photographer. I done a book on Dingle seascape and landscape. So I've been taking these photographs for the last 5 years, and then decided, look, I need to now put them into a collection. And then I went about doing it. And first of all, I created the book myself by printing all the images and sticking them into what the book would be, and then obviously go then to a printer. I was also adamant that this book was only printed in Ireland, and as my two books were printed, I wanted to print it in Ireland as well. I didn't want to send it off abroad.
And where can people get their hands on it?
It's available in Phillips Bookshop in Mallow and Dingle Bookshop, Presence of Mind in Clontarf, Sweet Pea in Dingle, and then of course on my website. It's available on my own website. I have an exhibition at the moment running with it, and that's currently in Cork Airport, and it's going to be there for a full month, and it's getting a huge reaction. I've printed all the images, not all of them, but a large selection of them into a large size and framed them, and are hanging there at the moment.
Okay.
So getting great reaction from
It's an incredible record. Incredible.
Yeah, it's a part of a culture that's basically disappearing. Like, you go into people's houses now and you don't see the Sacred Heart that much anymore, or different various things. At the door.
And the Sacred Heart lamp and the John F. K. and the old afternoon tea, Christmas biscuit tins are all there,
And like, when I've been posting them on Facebook as well, and people are getting great comments back, and when people see these straight away, it brings them back to that period of time in their own life, maybe their parents or their grandparents. A lot of interest from Irish Americans as well, because they identify with it. And it's gone.
Well done. It's a great project. By the way, when you were in photographing the abandoned houses, did anyone ever come along and say, I used to live there?
Yes, I try to get a bit of history as well about, you know, who lived there and what happened to them and why was it left. There's a lot of, like, when you're there as well, there's a lot of sadness as well, like, because, like, you're looking at people's personal belongings and things as well, and like, you sometimes when I'm there, because all these photographs are taken on tripod using available light and long exposure, so sometimes I'm there and you got this kind of silence in the house, and I often try to bring myself back, you know, and visualize people that live there, maybe children playing there, so there's that kind of sadness to it.
You do capture that brilliantly.
I try to do that. And,
okay, it's called the Ireland. We'll tweet a few photographs on Joe. At Joe Liveline or at RTE Liveline, Ireland the Way We Were by John Hooton. Again, even if you Google this, you'll get it straightforwardly enough. Thanks indeed, John. It's Cora Murphy there. Cora, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Thanks for having me on. And again, another beautiful production of your paintings, basically, isn't it, Cora? It's called Cora Home, 10 Years of Painting in Ireland, Cora Murphy. Tell us why you did it.
So I moved back to Ireland, Joe, 10 years ago after following 15 years overseas, and before I came to painting and art quite late, but when I came back to Ireland, I had to start driving, and I think for the first time in my life, I was actually looking where I was going, and somehow these landscapes started to appear. So over the last 10 years, I've made bodies of work in response to the landscape. So on residency, say, down in Kilrenig and Kerry, and over in North Mayo, and I did a series on the Mayo Lakes. So it just kind of brings together, I suppose, the best of the work I've made in the last 10 years. And it's also, you know, I write a little bit in it. There's four essays. and about the major influences, but also about what it means to be at home. You know, having lived overseas mm-hmm. for a long time, it was this notion of actually feeling at home, at home. So, yeah, it's lovely.
And
to
where are the originals, Cora? Do you sell? I presume you try and sell the originals, do you?
Oh, I do. All of these works now are placed in collections with different people in Ireland and overseas. What I tend to do is, I was with galleries for years, but it kind of became unsustainable. So, and I still love working with galleries, but what I tend to do is I make a body of work and I have it professionally shot, and then I send it out to my mailing list, so they get first dibs, and then they go all over the world, and it's great. It just gives me a lot more time to paint.
And you also produce cards.
I do.
Blank cards, which are beautiful as well, yeah?
And I do a bit of teaching as well, which is gas, because I'm self-taught myself, but I think I'm kind of evidence that anyone can paint.
Well,
but you're a painter yourself.
I am not. Well, no, only in the sense of anyone can paint. I totally agree with that. If you want to paint, paint. Nothing's stopping
absolutely.
You. Go out and buy a little set of watercolours at Christmas and doodle around. No one has to know, and no one has to see them except yourself. But buy good paper, good paint and good brushes. That's all to get you going.
Absolutely. That's what I say to my students. You know, if you want to be a good painter, buy good materials.
Yeah. Yeah, and good materials are not overly expensive either. They really
yeah,
aren't.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Cora, congratulations on the book. It's called 10 Years of Painting. It's, again, another beautiful production. And Cora, you have a website, don't you? CoraMorphy.com, am I right?
I do, Joe, and it's important to say as well that this book, €5 from each book goes to the Simon community here in Cork. So it's €20 retail. I'm actually doing free shipping at the moment if you use coupon SHIPAHOY on the website on www.coramurphy.com. But €5 from every book sold is
okay.
going to help Simon for Give, people who aren't.
How apt, given the title and the subject matter. Thanks indeed, Cora Murphy and Cork. 51551joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
We are allowing people who, well, only a small section of them, unfortunately, because there's so many, but authors that have self-published their books for various reasons. And all of them, by the way, I cannot impress on you how really well-produced they are. They're fantastically well-produced. They're as professional as any book you'll see on the shelves of any of our great bookshops. Baron Benoni Robu. Baron, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good, thanks. It's called From Communist Romania to Irish Shores. What's your book about? Because it's not just a travel book, it's a self-help book as well, isn't it?
That's correct, Joe. It's a true story. It's my life story. And when I was 10 years old, to survive, I have to eat same potatoes you would feed the pigs.
Okay.
And they were not fresh. They were sour and they were gray and they were not tasty.
Okay.
But that day, I planted the seed of a dream. And I promise myself that will never happen again. And as I talk to you, Joe, I can say I'm living the dream.
And how did you arrive and from that, from communist Romania, when you were eating potatoes not fit for pigs, says you, and I know your friends in Ireland call you Ben. Ben, how did you arrive in Ireland?
Ireland is not the first country I arrive. I used to live before in Germany, in Italy, and I arrived by ferry, and I settled myself in Dublin, and I run my businesses here. I'm a landscaper. I own a few creches, and I'm a book author, and I'm a motivational speaker as well.
Okay. And what was the big, what changed? I know you said that when you were very young, you said, I will never eat the potatoes the pigs eat again. But what is your main, insofar as you can put it in one sentence, what is your main lesson in life, Ben?
Sure, the lesson is very simple. It's resilience. If you look outside the window today, people always have dreams, but they never, or they start a dream and then they give up after a few hurdles,
yeah.
after a few knocks. But you have to have that ability to bounce back. It's not a matter if you get knocked down. It's a matter if you get up and start again and have that resilience and that fortitude and faith as well. Faith plays a big part in keep going and not giving up until you reach your dream.
Joe Dolan, tell me about how Joe Dolan brought you to Ireland.
People don't believe that, but actually it's a love story behind that. And when I was in the high school, I wanted to impress a girl with an English song, but yeah. I never studied English in my school. We studied a little Russian, but never English. So I wanted to sing a song to her, a song by Joe Dolan, which was a big hit in Romania. Joe Dolan is massive. That time, Joe Dolan was massive yeah. in Romania. So I wanted to serenade a song called "It's You, It's You, It's You, the Only One You Want." You know that song?
Yeah, the one I'm thinking of.
But I had to give up that dream of impressing her because we get stuck after three lines of the song. We could not progress.
Okay, so, but you have progressed, Ben. It's really well produced. It's called How Eating Pig's Potatoes Almost Made Me a Billionaire, But Not How You Think. From Communist Romania to Irish Shores, Discovering the Essence of Life by the effervescent Baron Benoni Robu. Best of luck with it, Baron. And again, we're going up on our website now and details of how to get it. That's Ben. Andrew, where's Andrew Doherty? Andrew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
A lovely little book here called Before the Tide Went Out, Growing Up in a Traditional Irish Fishing Village, which is Cheek Point down in Wexford / Waterford.
Well, we're in County Waterford, Joe, right beside Faithleg in Faithleg House Hotel. But the river itself passes Cheek Point and it passes Passage East, Ballyhack, Duncannon, all the way out to the Hook and to Dunmore East.
And you are sea people. You really are off the sea, off the tides and of fishing down there. Now, I mentioned earlier on, Cyril Meehan mentioned at the start of the programme that incredible story about him nearly drowning. Tragically, that fatality did visit your family.
Well, it did a couple of times. An uncle of mine drowned while going aboard a ship in America in the 50s. But in my own case, it was my brother. I was 14 and he was 8, and it happened in the summer of 1980. Just a simple accident, and I suppose it could have happened to any of us at that point in time, but he slipped off of a raft on the riverside and fell into the tide, and the tides were very high and they were very strong at the time. I suppose very similar to the kind of weather we're having at the moment. Yeah. And he was swept away.
That was Joseph, but, my brother Joseph.
Thankfully, his body was found 4 days later.
Now, you're essentially, are you not an inland? What do you fish for now, Andrew?
Well, at the moment, Joe, in 1996, when my first child was born, I went back. I decided I'd better give up fishing because the income was dropping so severely at that point. We drift netted for salmon at Cheek Point. And above us then, the men would have used draft nets and the cot net men would have used the snap net. So we were, and it had gone on for centuries, really, in the area. So we would have done that in the summer, and in the winter time, then we would go fish herrings. And sometimes we would fish eel. So I describe all those events and how those actual practices took part in the area. But as I said, in 1996, I decided when my first child was born, Joel, that I better find some other way of life. And I actually went to college, trained as a community worker. And I suppose that's what I do now. And I write then in my part-time.
And you write very well. You write very well.
Thank you.
There's lots of compliments coming with the book as well. And I know you're not fishing for compliments, but it's called Before the Tide Went Out, Growing Up in a Traditional Irish Fishing Village. And Andrew Doherty is the man you've just been talking to. And Andrew, was it difficult to get a self-published, or is it? It's getting much easier, isn't it?
Well, it is easier. I would have thought writing the book was the hard part, but it was actually, and self-publishing, it was very easy. I did it with Lettertech down in Cork. It's the selling of it, it's the marketing of it, it's the promotion of it that you really struggle with, and that's why being interviewed by yourself is such a shot in the arm for me, to be honest with you, and for anyone, I suppose, any self-published authors out there, they'd be thrilled to be on the show and to have that profile.
And as I said, every book we're talking about today, and there's countless more upstairs that we couldn't get to, every book we're talking about today is beautifully produced. You would not spot the difference, as I say, if you laid out a whole slew of the top 10 books currently in the Irish book charts. That's Andrew Doherty. Thank you, Dean Andrew. Next book is a mighty tome. There it is, landing on my desk, literally. It is 500... How many pages, Paddy Brennan? 537, 38, 39, 40. It's called Limerick Music, and it's, again, beautifully produced, full colour. Paddy, why?
How are you, Joe? The idea for the book, Joe, came probably about 3 years ago, but the original idea would have been about 5 years ago, because I brought out a triple CD set for Milford Hospice of 62 Limerick songs,
okay,
all Limerick artists. So that was very successful. So as time went by, then I said, we might as well get this down in print, because we have the audio of the great history and the great talent that was in Limerick over the past 200 years. So then let's get this down in print, because I had looked around and I saw rugby books about Limerick, political books, I had seen sporting books and GA books, but I'd never seen a book dedicated to Limerick music. So it started out like that, to chronicle what happened in Limerick in the past 220 years.
No easy task. But as I say, it's so beautiful. It's such a record. How will people get it? And two, begin the other way. How did you manage to produce and get all this information together?
Well, Joe, it originally started off at about 150 pages. I would have been probably happy at that. But as time went by, when I saw the photographs, I realised, some of these guys in the photographs had fathers or grandfathers who were in operatic societies in the 40s, who may have been in classical music in the 1800s. So it blossomed from there, and it got bigger and bigger. And I just said, if I got a lead at all on any photograph or any idea, I followed it up. And I don't give up very easily. I follow up the whole way. That's where you can see in the book, the majority of the photographs have names. Practically every photograph of all the names of everybody who's in every photograph.
And I cannot, again, a radio program cannot adequately impart the achievement of this incredible book. By the way, the President of Ireland, Michael O'Higgins, writes inside, "We owe a great debt of gratitude to Paddy Brennan for the impressive scope of this book. It is a greatly inspiring history compiled by a music lover who has devoted himself generously to this project, a project that will add much to our understanding of the musical history of Ireland." Hear, hear. How can people get the book?
Well, Joe, it's on sale in bookshops in Limerick.
Right.
It's on sale in O'Mahony's in O'Connell Street in the Celtic.
That's a big shop, yeah. Two great shops.
Eastons of the Parkway. It's in the Castletroy Trading Talking Leaves. And it's also in the Crescent Bookshop.
And make sure you deposit now copies with the National Library, and because it's such an important record, so to speak. Yep. It's called Limerick Music Throughout the Decades by Paddy Brennan. As he said, it's available in those great bookshops in around Limerick City Centre. It's only 30 quid, and I'm telling you, looking at the production, it is worth a lot more than 30 quid. And anyone interested in Limerick and indeed Limerick music, from the Granny's Intentions.
Nice Christmas present to give for €30.
Sure is, Paddy. Well done, Paddy. Have you written any other books?
Well, about 20 years ago, I did a small book, 100 pages, of the Showbands, all about the Showbands in Ireland. And that sold out as well. I only got a few hundred copies done, but Eddie Kelly was involved with me then, the great Eddie Kelly from Longford.
And how many copies of this massive tome have you printed?
1,000 copies of this, and it looks, Joe, it looks, and especially with your help today, it looks like this will be gone before next week.
Well, it's a it really is an important document, and beautifully produced. It'll keep people mesmerised for hours. Well done, Paddy Brennan. Throughout the decades, Limerick music. We'll put that up on our website as well. We'll be back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Dave Fanning still reeling from the sacking of Jose Mourinho. Dave, how are you? Something like that.
Makes no difference to me. I'm delighted, frankly.
No, you are. Who's Liverpool? Is that your team?
No, actually, funny thing is, this is a really weird thing. I would watch anything. Like, even as they say, don't forget to watch on Friday, a vital mid-table clash between Charlton Athletic and Oldham. I'd say, great, I'll watch that. I don't follow a team. My son follows Liverpool. I don't follow anybody.
Well, when we were talking last week about something, as you said, that I was going to go to a particularly brilliant concert somewhere, and you said
I was going to go to Snow Patrol on the Tuesday. I was going to do something else on the Tuesday, but I gave the tickets away to somebody else because I just had to see Liverpool and Napoli. I just wanted to see, and it was worth every second of it because the excitement towards the end was amazing.
Your true love. We also, your great interest in books. You're, by the way, Dave Fanning on 9 to 11 every Saturday morning to FM, and indeed every Sunday morning as well. Give us an idea of the books that tickled your fancy this year, David.
Okay, well, one of them would be, and you'd think, oh my God, do I really want to read another book about John Lennon? And to be honest, I started off this Ray Connolly book and thinking, I don't know. And then I found myself in three sittings just reading the whole thing, because you can either go over stuff you know already or find out something new. A problem might be that he did interview Yoko for the book, and therefore he's not as cruel to Yoko. God, that's the wrong word to use, but he's not as unfair to Yoko. Oh, that's the wrong word too. Basically, when people used to say the Beatles broke up and I blame Yoko, I kind of do blame Yoko in a lot of ways. So he's a bit nicer to her than he should be. But John Lennon, a restless life is what it's called. And that's putting it bluntly. He's a difficult man, and it's a damn fine book by Ray Connolly.
Okay, and John Lennon. Julian Gough also has a musical musical background, but he's an accomplished novelist at this time.
Yeah, over from the Midlands of Ireland, then growing up in Galway, we used to play his band a lot, Toasted Heretic. And Julian Gough was on about his third or fourth now. It's called Connect. And if I say the things in it, like solar powered robot hoovers and fridges, the talk and all the rest. The problem with all that is, if it's a hyper-digital thriller, a lot of people would say, I don't want to know. Actually, it's just a straightforward thriller. A bizarre scene about a young guy who lives in a kind of a virtual reality world, and he even has his headphones modified so he can shower in them. He never takes them off. He lives there all the time. And his mother has learned to kind of regrow limbs from caterpillars. I know it sounds crazy. And then the American military get involved, and it's completely bonkers. But it's just a good thriller. It's called Connect.
And I know you also liked, as a lot of people did, Normal People by Sally Rooney. But go on to those two other books. Notes on it, because we're talking about Sally later on.
My two main books this year are kind of slightly related in some ways. One of them is Matt Haig, who we spoke to on the programme actually a few months ago. It's called Notes on a Nervous Planet. Mm-hmm. And basically it's about a guy who's basically asking questions like how we can stay sane on this planet, how do we stay human in a technological world, how do we feel happy when we're encouraged to be anxious. And basically he is a kind of an anxious guy, and he does have certain kind of problems with his mental health, and he has to try and negotiate the world that we live in now, which is very difficult. And it's a very funny book. It's very easy to read. You can dip in at any point too. You don't have to necessarily go from A to Z in the book. But the other one related to
did you get a new lesson in life from the book, Dave?
Oh God, yeah. Oh my God, plenty of good lessons. Well, the basic one is, tune in maybe to a radio, but switch off from social media, because it's not necessarily doing us any good. And that's why I want to bring it on to the other book, which is much more about that kind of thing. It's called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. Okay, the title obviously tells you exactly what you should do, but this is by a guy called Jaron Lanier. And Jaron Lanier is pretty famous. He's written books like this before, and he was talking about the dangers of social media years ago. And it's very witty, and it's very urgent. It's a manifesto, basically. And basically, he shows you how social media works, shows you exactly what's happening from the middle of where he was working from all his life, which is Silicon Valley, and the constant surveillance, the subconscious manipulation of its users. And basically, people from 8 to 80 are walking around at the moment with a very sophisticated computer in their back pockets, and don't think that doesn't have its downside. It does.
Have you got, do you Facebook, do you tweet, do you
Instagram,
do you Snapchat?
I'm not Facebook, the programme tweets, so there's a few tweets. I'll tell you, I have a kind of a Twitter roadie. My son comes to me every week and goes, okay, you better answer these ones here. I don't really do a lot of it myself. I've never been on Facebook, and the programme obviously on the radio does all that stuff as well. But me personally, not really. Having said that, I'm like a lot of people. I have a mobile phone, I know how to use about 10% of it, is all I want. I wouldn't mind learning the other 40% to get at least halfway, but it's not going to worry me if I don't.
Okay. Normal People by Sally Rooney, Being John Lennon, Restless by Ray Connolly, Connect by Julian Gough, Notes on the Nervous Planet by Matt Haig, and the arguments for deleting your social media accounts right now. Have you seen the new Mary Poppins movie? Someone wants to know.
I have not seen the new Mary Poppins movie, no. In fact, you know something? I can't even remember the old one very well.
Julie Andrews going way back. Dick Van Dyke, is it? Okay, yeah, Dave Fanning. Thanks indeed, Dave. Thanks. That's
Come
Dave
on,
Fanning. Again, all
business.
Dave's books are going up on our well, don't say it until he's off the air, on our Twitter account now. Owen McDevitt, Owen, host of Second Captain's Podcast. Owen, good afternoon.
Joe, great to talk to you.
Likewise, give us five sports books.
Five sports books. Sorry, I'll start with Andy Lee then. I think a man who appeared on your show not that long ago, having done a good turn for his father-in-law.
That's right, Danny.
So that's the kind of guy you're dealing with, one of the most likable men in Irish sport, I would say, but also one of the deepest thinkers. So he's got his autobiography out. It's called Fighter, written with Niall Kelly. Talks about his professional career in the legendary Detroit gym called Kronk with Emmanuel Sura, the trainer over there. So lots of good boxing stuff, but what marks it out really is his ability to be philosophical about these things. He talks about fighting as you don't know what you are until you're in a fight. It's one of the last tests like this left in the world. So he's incredible at bringing you into the mindset of somebody who goes into the ring and has to fight for a living. He also talks about his gypsy background. People, he says in the book, don't really know that he's a gypsy. So he tends to hear snide remarks and sees things that otherwise he might not see and hear. It's the first time he's really spoken about that element of his life as well. So there's a lot in there. There's a lot more than just a standard, this is how my career went from A to Z.
And a sports book, but on gambling and gambling addiction.
That's Tony Tan, Declan Lynch and Tony O'Reilly. Declan Lynch has written for the Sunday Independent for a long time about the problems that can be posed by gambling, well, certainly by gambling addiction. And he has written the story of Tony O'Reilly. I don't know if people remember this guy a few years ago. He made front page news, a post office manager from Gorey who went to prison for stealing €1.75 million, I think it was, from On Post while addicted to gambling. So this tells a story of the damage done to his life. Obviously, he ended up in prison, but his own wedding day is destroyed, really, for him anyway, because he's consumed with thoughts of how he's going to get the money to actually pay for it. His relationship with his mother breaks down when he's arrested. Really, really horrible stuff.
But shocking stories in it on about the big betting companies and how they wouldn't let him go. How they came after him saying, I'm not looking for money, but looking for him to bet more.
Incredible. Well, there's a story in there of him apparently receiving a phone call from Paddy Power when the website was down, just checking in with him and making sure he was aware that even though the website was down, he was welcome to place some bets on the phone. He was invited to the Europa League final, to the Irish Derby. This is the kind of stuff that gambling companies do, and they say that they're better now, that they're much better at having safeguards in place to recognise people who might be problem gamblers. But even this week, there was a story in The Guardian about Ladbrokes in the UK. They're being investigated over claims that they agreed to pay the victims of a gambling addict who essentially had stolen money from clients. That there's an allegation that Ladbrokes paid these people in return for a pledge not to inform the industry regulator. So it seems like sport and gambling is very intertwined these days in a way that maybe isn't particularly healthy, and this book certainly shines a light on all of that. Tiger Woods is another one.
Go ahead, Tiger Woods. This is the book that Tiger didn't cooperate with at all.
I don't know if he'd like it too much, to be honest. It paints a fairly complete picture. Not a complete picture of him at all, actually, but a more complete picture than anything we've got to this point. Talks about his childhood, which was an odd one, really. Like, he had a father who was talking about him as being, what was the quote in the book? Tiger will do more than any other man in history to change the course of humanity. This is something that he said when Tiger was a young man.
No pressure,
No pressure at all. His father and mother didn't really give him any of the tools to have the ability to do anything like that. In fact, it's kind of easy to see how Tiger became somebody who struggles really to interact very well with people around him. His mother was as ambitious as his father was and really didn't like friends or girlfriends or anything like that getting in the way of his academics or his golf career. So you don't end up liking Tiger any better when you read this book, although I do think you understand how he ended up without a basic ability to deal with people in his life.
And talk about timing, the year that was in it. What for Tiger?
Amazing, the
comeback. The Lost Soul of Eamon McGee, getting incredible reviews, winning awards left, right and centre by Paul D. Gibson. Eamon McGee, the boxer.
The Boxer, another boxing book, yeah. Boxing tends to, I think, of all the sports produced, probably traditionally the greatest sports books, and it's come good again this year. Now, I would caution, this is a difficult book, and Eamon McGee is a difficult character. He was a really good boxer, a world champion. He nearly beat Ricky Hatton early in Ricky Hatton's career. But it's his life story, really, that's grimly fascinating. You know, he's from the Ardoyne area of Belfast. He grew up, his earliest memories of his father is going into prison, into Lancash, to bring some contraband in. Eamon himself joined the youth wing of the IRA for a period. He moved away from that life, but was later shot in the leg by the IRA for dealing drugs. There's a load of violence in this book. He says, I've been beaten with baseball bats. I've had my throat slashed. I've been kidnapped. I've been exiled out of the country. I've been shot twice. I've been in prison. And my son has been stabbed to death. So some awful things have happened to this man. Yeah, some really awful things. But I would say where I have trouble is he doesn't seem to accept responsibility for anything that he's done. Obviously, some things are unavoidable. Some instances were just tragedies. But he still drinks every day. He would say that himself. He drinks from when he gets up to when he goes to bed. He has that issue. And he's very much in the middle of this mess. You know the way a lot of these books you would read maybe 10 years after somebody has gone sober, or they're very, quite reflective on their life and they see their own faults. You don't have any of that reflection in this book, so I don't think you come away loving the central character, but there's a certain grim fascination, as I said, about his story. Right?
And isn't it fascinating? As I said, The Lost Soul of Eamon McGee, a true story, but set in Ardoyne area of North Belfast, and Milkman by Anna Burns, which won the Man Booker Prize, is also set in Ardoyne. There's two, one a novel, one non-fiction, but both of them featuring really strongly at the end of the year. Does that tell us something about the Troubles, and are we willing to talk about them and go over and excavate them? Yeah. But your final book is by well-known academic and fine writer, Paul Rowse.
He is a fine writer, and he had a go at inter-county management this year as well. Paul Rowse came to the rescue of the Offaly footballers and did a good job during the summer. But he's written about the first ever All-Ireland Hurling Championship, a sport that was pretty much extinct in 1882 when an anonymous letter appeared in the Irish Times calling for the revival of this traditional game. And it was revived largely thanks to Michael Husak, who appears as the star of this book. He's a real larger-than-life character, someone I didn't know as much about as I feel I probably should have. He'd kind of stride around Dublin wearing carrying a blackthorn stick, big, broad-shouldered, bearded man, devotes himself to the revival of hurling with a real evangelical zeal, and manages to do it. Within a few years, there's the GAA exists because of him and one or two others, and the All-Ireland Hurling Championship existed, although he's also a bit of a troubled genius and seems to fall out with pretty much everybody at some point by the time the first All-Ireland Finals played. He's actually been removed as Secretary of the GAA. It's only a few years after he started it up. There's also lots of great stuff about the wider context of Ireland. Obviously, the late 1800s, it was in the middle of the land war, so you have players playing in an All-Ireland one day and being evicted from their farms the next day. All that kind of,
okay,
that kind of thing.
That's all. Owen McDevitt of say listening, Owen, because I think the next book you might have on Second Captain's podcast at some stage, if you already haven't, you're always on the ball anyway. You probably had it about a month ago. But Adrian Walsh. Adrian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Is this your first time on radio?
Sorry?
Is this your first time to be interviewed about your book?
Yes, it is, actually.
Okay,
I've had a couple of other radio programs, but it's quite a few months now since I've had an interview.
Okay, will you be on Second Captain soon? Because it's called The Adrian Walsh Way of Total Control. You're the 3-time world record holder for ball skills. And this is another fascinating book for someone who's brutal at sports, me. It's a list of do's and don'ts and proper warm-ups, flexibility and ankle strength, the importance of how to do your boots and do them properly. Tell me about your world record for a start.
Well, they were area world records, and I'm trying to get the biggest, the reason I did them was the biggest stat in the English league, and they used to ridicule the Americans for all the stats they were doing, and now they have hundreds of stats themselves, but the biggest stat is kicking with both feet.
Okay.
And that's been swept under the carpet. So my next plan is, having had those area control records, is I'm going to, it's planned to do in Cork in the beginning of the new year, I'm training for it, to dribble 2 footballs, one on each foot, using the inside and outside of both feet. The first one will be over 60 feet, the second one will be over 60 yards, and the third one will be taking it around the pitch to try and nail this once and for all, that there's a myth going out there that you have to do this when you're young. True, it benefits when you're young, But I learned to dribble two footballs at the age of 30. So the movements come, as I say, from dancers.
So you're ready dancers, to set... You're ready
yeah, dancers,
to...
yeah, dancers do these movements at different... And they change routines, as you know, at all different ages of their life. So footballers should be able to do this.
Okay, so you're basic. And it's this is a book that you can use to help your game.
Yes.
But you believe pro footballers should be kicking with both feet.
Without a doubt.
And you can dance too.
And I can dance to the music with 2 feet, yes.
Bobby Charlton, what have Bobby Charlton, Pelé and Harry Kane got in common? They're both can play with left and right.
Yes, left and right, yes.
Okay. Well done. It's called Football Total Control, the Adrian Walsh way. And again, all information up on our website within minutes, and we'll tweet them as well. Thanks indeed, Owen McDevitt from Second Captains. In Pursuit of Perfection, Irene O'Brien. Irene, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And it's not written by you, it's written by your sister, but unfortunately she passed away.
That's right, yeah.
So what is the book about?
The book is about two Irish girlfriends, and Emily and Maria. And Emily was doing charity work in Africa, and she decided to call in to visit her friend Maria, who is in Melbourne, married in Melbourne. She actually married into a very wealthy Australian family. And the family disliked Maria because she wasn't glamorous enough. They were all into Botox and facelifts and all that kind of stuff. And she was a plain Irish girl in their eyes, and they disliked her. But her husband loved her, Sam, and as a wedding gift, he gave her some corporate shares in the company he worked for. And that's the part of the intrigue in the story.
Okay, because it is a murder. Is it a murder mystery?
It's a murder mystery, okay. But there's loads of romance in it as well.
Okay, and your sister, tell us the story of the book, because she passed away. Had she completed the book before she passed
away?
She
had completed the book, but it hadn't been edited, and she hadn't completed the very last page. And after she died, my brother Mick had her laptop, and he found the book on it. And he decided then, he discussed it with the rest of us, and we decided that we would have the book printed in memory of her instead of
a
memorial card.
Well done. And what, you distributed it to our friends? And
yeah, we just got 50 printed, and we gave it to family and friends, and the feedback from the book is brilliant. Like, Adeline loved romantic films and all murder mysteries, and she went to cinemas regularly, and so she was a great storyteller even as a child. She was the middle of nine of us.
What age was Adeline when she passed away?
She was 75.
Yeah, still young. And it's a lovely idea, but it's also available as an e-book, isn't it, to our listeners?
It is, yeah, through e-print.
Okay, it's called In Pursuit of Perfection by Adeline Bolton. Let me bring in Jane Landy. Jane, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
It's called Granger the Winger. It's our first children's book today.
That's right, yeah.
And tell us what it's about.
Well, Granger the Winger is a book based on a dragon that I invented when my kids were all small.
Okay.
And he would arrive, particularly at mealtimes when things were pretty tense. So at one stage, I had a 6-year-old, a 3-year-old, and twin baby boys, and all hell would break loose at mealtimes. So I would knock on the door and to distract them, and this dragon voice would then appear saying, "Hello there, Mammy." And I'd say, "Oh no, not Granger." So I would pretend that we didn't want the dragon at all while doing the dragon voice and demanding to eat the children's food, which of course would get them to eat up their own food. And it just worked a treat. And it was great for me because it meant I didn't have to get cross and frustrated. And they were vastly amused.
What a great idea.
I kept them going for years and years.
And how did you decide, or when did you decide to try and put it into book form, which have succeeded fantastically at, by the way?
Oh, thank you very much.
Beautifully illustrated by Sheena Dempsey.
Yeah, Sheena Dempsey. I was so lucky to find Sheena. She was on Illustrators Ireland and also recommended by Niamh Sharkey, who's another Skerry's very well-known writer and children's illustrator. So about 3 years ago, I'd been running this school book business that I'd started from my garden shed when my youngest ones went to school.
Yeah.
And about 3 years ago, I thought, oh God, I would just love so much to produce a children's book. And my husband said to me, well, there's only one book then that you'll have to produce, and that will have to be Gringer.
Ah, super.
Because
super.
Gringer had been like a member of the family for so many years. And although he used to drive my husband mad, he hated listening to the whingy dragon voices. He was really keen that I should have a shot at doing something with Gringer.
Okay, well, you've done it brilliantly. How can people get their hands on it?
Well, he's in pretty much all the independent bookshops around the country, and also from several online stockers. So Mahoney's in Limerick, Kenny's, Waterstones, but we've a website, GringerTheWhinger.com, and the whole backstory and some of Sheena's illustrations and the list of stockets, they're all on the website.
Okay, and Landy is a great name in Irish writing as well.
Isn't it? Indeed, my illustrious neighbour in Lusk.
Your neighbour yours, is he? Derek,
he's up the road in Lusk. I'm in Skerries.
It's called Gringer the Whinger.
All about whinging.
Jane Landy and Sheena, what a great idea. Thanks indeed, Jane Landy. 51551.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Michal Brett. Michal, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
Good. It says here in your beautiful book, Michal Brett is a creative and talented individual with a passion for music, theatre, and most importantly, circus. Did you want to run away and join the circus?
I did. I always wanted to run away with the circus, like.
And what age are you now, Michal?
I am 25.
And you love circus?
Yeah.
Tell me all the circuses you've been to see.
I've always loved going to them and seeing them and just seeing them all.
Okay, well done. And the book is called Michal and the Magical Circus. It's yourself, Michal, and you're helped by Sarah Brennan, isn't that right?
She did
illustration. And what's the story about? Is it aimed at children, Michal?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. And what's the story about? There's a ringmaster in it.
Yeah, and it's to do with my mom and myself, and I'm given a gift, and I'm delighted with it, and I become my own ringmaster.
Yes, that's the whole idea, isn't it? Because you say, and hopefully you will one day become a ringmaster, but as you say, I couldn't at this stage, so I decided to write about being a ringmaster. And as you say, it's aimed at children, and it's a great achievement, Michal. Congratulations. Yeah. It's great to have your name on it. And there's your photograph on the back with your little doggy. What's your doggy's name?
Millie
and Michal, you're a great team. Thanks indeed. That's Michal and the Magical Circus by Michal Brett and Sarah Brennan. Let's do crime for a few minutes, so to speak. And every year we ask Patricia Casey, the psychiatrist, because she's a big interest in crime novels and usually picks crackers for the year. Patricia, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Did you get much reading done this year?
Well, I did, and I got a lot of new interesting reading done some writers that I had never heard of. It's all crime fiction. Camilla Läckberg is a Swedish female writer. Now, I've read her before, but I read a very difficult book of hers this year called The Girl in the Woods, and it's also called The Witch.
Okay.
And it's quite complex to read because it's really two stories embedded one. The Girl in the Woods is about a little 4 or 5 year old girl who lives with her parents, an only child, and she disappears. She disappears and is eventually found dead quite early on in the story. She's found murdered, and it transpires that there were there was another child who had disappeared 30 years earlier and was found dead at the same site. And the two people who were charged with her disappearance and murder are now suspected in the current case. So there's all of that, and because it's about a child disappearing, it's very tragic and very sad. But it's intertwined with a story about a witch being burnt and about witch trials in Sweden, which did happen. It's true; they did happen between 1665 and 1676. And this is a story of a witch, of a woman who was a widow with a daughter, an only child, and she was found guilty of being a witch and was duly burnt at the stake. And the two stories, there's a complex connection between the two stories, between the disappearance of the little girl now and this story from 400 years earlier. It's a very well-written book. It's difficult. It's emotionally difficult. And it's emotionally difficult because Camilla Läckberg and mixes the couple that investigated, her husband and wife couple, a man called Patrick Hedstrom. He's the detective in all of her novels. Mm-hmm. And his wife, who is actually a crime writer, the two of them investigate this crime. And so their home life is domestic bliss. You know, they've got two children, they're happily married. But all of the coziness of the home and her mother, who was widowed, getting remarried again, all of that is brought to life at the same time that they're investigating this terribly tragic case.
There's a lot going on. It's written by Camilla Läckberg, and we put it up, and it's called The Girl in the Woods. Now, once again, you recommend Donna Leon, the Venetian writer, to tempt. Yes. This one is called The Temptation of Forgiveness. But what you do say in this one, and I think you've said it before, which is a great lead for people, that Leon's books are very easy to read and to follow, and it's the same Commissioner Guido Brunetti in all of them. That's called The Temptation of Forgiveness. Now, the other Swedish writer is Johan Tjörn.
Johan Tjörn, yes. I happen to... his books are very difficult to get, and I was only able to get one at Dance in Marylebone, which is a beautiful bookshop if anybody's in London. But my son was in Sweden at a conference in Malmo, and he got it for me there, a signed copy. And they're set in the island of Åland, which actually does exist off the southeast coast of Sweden. And he's done four or five books set there. And they're all to do with remembering the past and how things have changed, and we're now in this modern island where people are coming to live and build huge new houses and who have forgotten about the past. And it's narrated by a man who had been living in an assisted living home and leaves it because he hates it, and he now lives in his own house and is barely coping, but he hears and sees everything that goes on, so he sort of narrates it. And it's mixed in with some magic, like elves and trolls and things like that. So it's a nice story to read. It's not too taxing, but they are difficult books to get. Okay. They've only been translated into English recently, so that's why they haven't been widely available.
Okay, and you also we'll put your full list up because we're shortly out of time. But you also recommend Jordan B. Peterson, who is the Canadian. He's a big following in Ireland. He was here during the year, Patricia.
Yes, I went to see him. I went to see him. The 12 Rules of Life. It's a very easy read. Okay. You can pick up a chapter and put it down. He's also done YouTube clips of most of the chapters, and so that's nice. And it's I suppose like being a detective, exploring yourself and your own human needs and your own frailties. Sometimes it can be repetitive, and I think it's best if it's combined with the YouTube clips. He's actually a better speaker than he is a writer.
Okay, he's a very...
But nevertheless, it's a book that you can pick up at any time, and I think it's worth dipping into.
Okay, well done. And the other book, that's psychiatrist Patricia Casey. The other book is called The Fire Engine That Disappeared by another Scandinavian author, Madge Sowell and Peter Walu. But we'll put all those details up on our website. 51551. Thanks, Patricia.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Sarah Dunne, whose self-published book is called The Tunnel. Who's it aimed at, Sarah?
So the book is... Thanks very much for having me on. I'm delighted to kind of chat with you this afternoon about it. So The Tunnel is a book. It's kind of for 9+. So in bookshops, it'll be between 9 and the 9 to 12-year-old section.
Great.
But I've had amazing feedback. Anyone kind of over the age of 9 can read it.
And The Tunnel is located near... it's a novel, obviously, but The Tunnel is located near where you live.
Yeah, so as growing up, I used to hear these stories, these great old stories from people who've lived in the area for years and years, and all these kind of old stories and the people and the places that they would have known growing up back, I suppose, even back in the 30s and 40s. And one of these stories that really caught my imagination was the story about a tunnel. I can't find any evidence that the tunnel actually exists. Loads of people have do swear to its existence and that, but I can't find it actually documented anywhere.
But you bring it to life. That's the fantastic thing about it. And every child loves the idea of going in one side of a tunnel and what's going to be on the other side. You're on Instagram as sarahdonahue.author. There's a blog. Sarah, just Google Sarah Donahue and you'll get the tunnel. Another beautiful production. And again, great to finish in a book that's aimed at that age group from 9 to 13. There are so many other books here, so many other books upstairs, all self-published, all with great stories in them and behind them. And I think we're going to go. Yes, we will continue it tomorrow. Fergus Sweeney has just given the thumbs up, who produced today. And Ray Darcy is next.